Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. And a beautiful Shabbat it is, say the least. Boy, nothing like New England. I'd like to turn in the Siddur with you just for a minute. If you get your Siddur out, and I'd like you to look with me at a particular passage in the Siddur because it frames what we're going to be talking about today. So if you look with me at page 46, and we're looking at the second bracha, the second blessing of the Amidah. We do this every Shabbat. Many of you, of course, know that there's a longer form of the Amidah on weekdays, but on Saturday, on Shabbat, there are seven blessings, and the second one, it's called God's Might. And what I'd like us to do, we're not doing it in liturgical context right now, but I'd like us to just become familiar with this passage. So I'm just going to ask you to read the English with me. You are mighty forever, O Lord, giving life to the dead. Great is your saving power. You sustain the living with steadfast love, give life to the dead with great compassion, uphold the failing, heal the sick, free those who are in bondage, and keep faith with those who sleep in the dust. Who is like you, Lord of might? And who can be compared to you, O King, who brings death, restores life, and causes salvation to flourish? And then at the bottom, you are faithful in giving life to the dead. Blessed are you, O living one, who gives life to the dead. Now, this is all about the idea of resurrection. And that's what we want to talk about. And we're going to be going through the passage that we read this morning, our Besorah reading, as a backdrop to why this idea is important for us as modern 21st century people. It's one thing to think about it as an archaic, ancient idea that, well, you know, they believed in that, but we're smarter than that now, or something like that. I want to suggest to you that the concept is very important at multiple levels. But before getting into the application, I'd like us to look again at our Besorah reading, and I'd like to make a few observations about what's happening in this fantastic passage. It is so great. It is so exciting. It's one of my all-time favorites. So we're going to pick up where we started today, and we're actually in the middle of the account because last week we read about how Yeshua and his followers learned that Lazarus, or Eleazar, was sick, and Yeshua wanted to not go too quickly to heal him or do anything for him. He wanted to wait, and actually waited for 4 days. And maybe you wonder, why would he wait? What's the purpose there? Well, part of the answer has to do with a custom that may have been present in this early period of Jewish history, and that is the idea that when a person died, their neshama, or their soul, would hover over the body for 3 days because there was the potential within that three-day period for resurrection to occur. But after 3 days, that was it. Now, we don't know for absolute certain that this custom was part of the mix in first century Israel, but many customs which are written down later have their origins in earlier times. Oftentimes there's a real stability to customs and traditions. But we can guess then, or surmise, that Yeshua wanted to wait because he wanted it to be very clear that Lazarus, Eleazar, was dead. And that's why he didn't hurry to assist him or his sisters. So, on his arrival, Yeshua found that Lazarus, I'll use that form of the name, that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethania, or Bethany, was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem. I should say a little bit about this town. A Beit Anya means the house of the poor. Seems to be a very poor village. And some people have suggested that this may have been an Essene village because the Essenes were known to care for poor people and had many outposts throughout Israel. They weren't limited to, sometimes people think, the Dead Sea community. No, they were in Jerusalem. They were at various places. And so this is a poor town. So just think about a poor town you know about, and that might suggest Bethany. But it was 2 miles from Jerusalem. And many Judeans came to Martha and Miriam to comfort them in the loss of their brother. Some of the English versions read many of the Jews, and some people misunderstand that. They think these are just the Jewish people. Well, they are Jewish people we're talking about here, but specifically they're people from this section of Israel called Judea, Judeans. So that's what we're seeing here. They are not necessarily just Jews in the broader or generic sense, but these are people who were Judeans from that area. And sometimes the connotation of Judeans has the idea of antagonists to Yeshua. He was better accepted in the Galilee, in the northern part of Israel, but Judeans, we read many times, were skeptical about him. And we see a mixed picture here in this passage. They were with Miriam and Martha, according to ancient custom, and custom today too, sharing in the grief of a dead person that you care about. Very, very important. And that custom is very much part of Jewish life to this day. When Martha had heard that Yeshua was coming, she went out to meet him, but Miriam stayed at home. And that's because Yeshua hadn't gone into the town. He was on the outskirts. Lord. And Lord here doesn't have the connotation of deity or anything like that. It just means master, sir. It's an honorific title, but it doesn't have to have any supernatural connotation in this passage. Lord, Martha said to Yeshua, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. And so she was well aware, as more and more people were becoming aware, that Yeshua was a special guy and that he could even heal her brother even after this period, the 3-day period and all. Yeshua said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Now the idea of resurrection was part of the general framework, what people believed back in those days. It was a Jewish doctrine that was very important. The idea is that at the end of the age, God would bring faithful people back to life again. And I would guess that some of the people back then wondered, well, how could that possibly be? Just as we in our modern scientific age would say, how can that be? I mean, what if you died at sea and the sailors threw your dead body over the side of the boat and you decomposed because fish ate you and then the fish died and became coral? So there you are, some of your DNA and some of you, the original Nathan, is in the coral. And there's Connie. She's a piece of coral. And how could... Well, I think we have to just recognize that God is so powerful, he could take a subatomic particle of your body and resurrect you. I mean, he doesn't need to work through the normal methods of physics or the ways of physics. And I think it's one of those things that back then and today, there is a faith element in that we don't understand the mechanism. We don't get the mechanism. But the mechanism is utterly secondary because God can do whatever he wants. Would you affirm that today? He can do whatever he wants. But she says, I know he'll be okay. Ultimately, one day, Yeshua said to her, and this is a great line. Get this. Verse 25, Yeshua said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. What a claim. Do you get that? Wow. I mean, it takes your breath away. He is so special. And in this intimate conversation with her, other people are undoubtedly around, but he's talking to her and says, I'm the resurrection of the life. I mean, who says such things? Well, he can say it because he means it because that's who he is. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord, she replied. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world. And after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Miriam. The teacher is here, she said, and he's asking for you. When Miriam heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now, Yeshua had not entered the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him, again on the outskirts of the village. When the Judeans, who had been with Miriam in the house comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to mourn there. And I can imagine it was primarily women who followed at this point, that the women who were there to comfort her went and followed her. But then in time, men show up as well. But just the way I conceive of it, if I were to do a movie of this. When Miriam reached the place where Yeshua was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Why did she say that? Because she had witnessed some of the supernatural things that he had done, healing people. And she says, "Why couldn't you show up a little earlier? I mean, we're in trouble now. He was the major breadwinner in the house. We loved him. He's gone. And now we're two women and we're vulnerable, and what are we going to do?" Again, we're kind of imagining the kind of social situation and the things that were in her mind. It was love for her brother and also a sense of vulnerability that may have motivated why she would fall down in front of Yeshua and say, "You could have, why didn't you show up? I mean, you helped so many people. Couldn't you show up in time to help us? Were you good friends?" You know, you go around and loving the whole world, but what about loving the people who were near you? I mean, can we talk about, she's angry. And she's angry in part, I would imagine, because anger is part of the stage, one of the stages of grief, you know? It's not that easy to accommodate the fact that all of a sudden, person you had depended on is just gone. When Yeshua saw her weeping, and the Judeans who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Let's stop there for a minute. What was it about the situation that caused him to weep? Well, first of all, we understand that the whole nature of burial, and we see some evidence of this in the way we bury people nowadays in Jewish tradition, that the whole idea is to facilitate grief, to facilitate a person feeling what they need to feel. And we've had a number of deaths in the congregation. And what I always tell people is, look, allow yourself to feel what you feel. If you feel like crying, you cry. If you don't beat yourself up for not feeling that way. You got to let yourself feel what you feel. And we gather at the house and have a minyan and say the Kaddish, and you sit around at Shiva and you talk about the person. And sometimes it doesn't go this way. Sometimes it ends up kind of a strange, like a party. It's kind of a weird dynamic. But anyhow, the idea is to facilitate grieving. The halakhic principles, which for the first week and then the first 30 days and the whole year, are all in the interest of facilitating grieving. Because here's the thing. If you don't grieve then, it's like pay now or pay later. You don't want to go through life with unresolved feelings and issues about the loss of somebody. And maybe you need to spend some time forgiving them. And whatever you need to do, that's what you need to do. So here we see everyone weeping for her. It's a very demonstrative culture. And everyone's weeping. And Yeshua is moved in spirit and troubled and weeping too. And maybe you ask, why would he cry? I mean, he knew what he was about to do. Well, let's hold off on answering that question for a few more verses. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. And then the verse, Yeshua wept. Shortest verse in the entire Besorah. Two words, Yeshua wept. So again, we revisit this question. If Yeshua knew what he was going to do, why would he cry? And I want to suggest to you that there are a couple of reasons. Number one, I think it was out of this genuine sense of participation in the sadness of the moment, because even though he is the source, ultimately, of the resurrection and the resolution of all things, still there is a sense in the Jewish outlook, which he was part of, that death is a kind of obscenity. That there's something fundamentally wrong with death. that weeping because of the obscenity of this guy who may have been 30 years old, the prime of life, all of a sudden has a heart attack or whatever was the source of his death, that this is, there's something fundamentally wrong about death. And to weep and to participate in the pathos of the moment and to recognize the obscenity of this, of the decay that every human being experiences little by little, the fact that young people die at Children's Hospital of cancer and all the other manifestations of this, I call it this obscenity, he participates in it because that is the truth. And that's why, again, getting back to funerals, I've been to some funerals in some religious contexts where people say, oh, joy, you know, Joe is with God now, and let's just have a rejoicing time. And I've always felt there's something wrong with that. There's something wrong with that. It doesn't fit the rhythm of the way things are supposed to go, and it doesn't properly acknowledge that death is the last enemy. And it's something that we understand intuitively and deeply. And Yeshua participates in it. And he participates in it also, I think, because he really cared about this guy. And then we have this point of contact between him as the Messiah and his divine nature, meeting with him as just the human being, participating in the experience, the human experience of the loss of this man. And he cries along with everyone else. We can't fully penetrate the inner psychology of Yeshua the Messiah. What does it mean to be the Messiah who knows the end from the beginning, the one promised to us who's going to bring about all the good things, the one who had the power of God flowing through him without measure? How does that interface with him just being a regular guy? We'll never, ever be able to penetrate that entirely. But we see it, the seeming contradiction, but I don't think it's a contradiction. I think it's two sides of a coin in a beautiful, magnificent way. Here we see it epitomized in these two little words. And Yeshua wept. And he may have wept for a long time, for all we know. Then people said, well, see how he loved him. But, and I love this passage, some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of a blind man have kept this man from dying? I love it. I love it. Because you see that sense of realism that permeates the gospel narratives. You see that sense of, it's exactly what you would expect people to say. Yeshua always evoked opposite emotions from people. And some embraced him and others were not so sure. And the gospels just reflect that because they're honest accounts, not idealized pictures of a superhero, but rather a picture of the way people really functioned in the presence of this magnificent human being who was so much more than a human being. Yeshua, once more, deeply moved, took a while, deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. Big stone. Stones are supposed to be about 2 tons, is an estimate of what stones would be like that covered at least the burial cave of a rich person. I'm not sure about in this case. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been in there for 4 days. Yeah, you'd expect that. Very realistic comment. She doesn't want her brother's memory to be tarnished with the indignity of having a bad smell emanate from the cave. Then Yeshua said, didn't I tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. And then Yeshua looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I know that you always hear me. But I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you have sent me. You find this in a number of passages where Yeshua prays and does it in a public way, and then he does a miracle so that the people would come to understand this unique relationship that he had with Avinu Malkeinu. When he had said this, Yeshua called out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. There was a pause. People waited. What is going to happen now? We don't smell anything. The dead man came out, hopping, I would suggest, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and cloth on his face. Jewish burial custom, a cloth on the face, binding of the hands and feet. We read about this in the death of Yeshua, also oftentimes a shroud covering the entire body, not mentioned here specifically. But he comes out, I'm imagining him kind of hopping out. Yeshua said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." How do you think the people reacted? Wow! I can imagine some in the crowd saying, "I think this was a setup." Kind of imagine that. But the local people knew the guy was really dead. They buried him. They knew the whole story. And even some of the visitors from Jerusalem, the Judeans who had come, who knew the family. Therefore, many of the Judeans who had come to visit Martha and had seen what Yeshua did, believed in him. But again, some went to the Perushim and told them what Yeshua had done. And then the chief priests and the Perushim called a meeting of the Sanhedrin, etc., etc. Now what we have here is a fabulous miracle. But putting it again within the context of Jewish understanding, in the Amidah, every day we say the same thing. Every day we celebrate the fact that there'll be a resurrection of the dead. Why should this be important to us as modern people? I'd like to suggest two reasons. Number one, the idea of resurrection of the dead should not be thought of strictly in individual terms. It's not just for us as individuals, or people as individuals. It also is part of the general picture of the fulfillment of God's promises to his people Israel. Think of the dry bones. Think of the promise of the resurrection at the end of the age, where God will fulfill his promises to all Israel, and by extension to the world too. It's not limited to Israel, but he's going to fulfill his promises. Michaye HaMetim is life from the dead for the nation. It's the resolution of all things after all the struggle, the ups and downs, the wars, the challenges, the difficulties, the judgments, as Joe mentioned, the judgments per in Leviticus per our disobedience, all of that. All of that ends up with a very happy ending, life from the dead. A second thing. You may ask, why do you need a body at the end of all things? Why can't you just function as a spirit? What do you need a body for? Because in the biblical picture, as captured in both Christianity and Judaism, the idea of a certain physicality to the life on the other side is part of the ultimate outcome. I won't get into that much more now. There's not a whole lot more I could say. But physicality, validating life in the flesh now, is part of the picture, as opposed to a more Greek philosophical idea that the body is the prison house of the soul, and really the idea is to get out of it because all it does is grow old and blah, blah, blah. No, the Jewish view is that the body is something God made and is part of the sacred equipment that he's given us to extol him through the ages, the resurrection of the dead in a very physical sense, and very important. And the last thing I want to say about this is the meaning for all of us, just as human beings, no matter when we live. Psychologists say, and researchers say, that there are five fundamental fears that we all have. I don't want to enumerate them because it's not necessary. But I want to talk about one of them with you, which the resurrection speaks to very directly, and that is the fear of annihilation. The fear that the you inside of you, the self-conscious you, may one day not exist at all. There will be no more you. You will be gone. And some modern people say, well, if I'm gone, what do I care? I mean, there's no more rational thought, so I'm gone. No, no, no. It's a fundamental fear that we all share of all that we experience in our life culminating in nothingness, vacuum. You're no longer there. A fundamental fear that the resurrection speaks to. God says, have no fear. You're always going to exist. You're always going to be you. And for those who love him and want him and want to be with him, he says, I got such great stuff planned on you. Think of the happiest moment in your life. Double it and then double it again and then multiply it by a one with 100 zeros and you haven't even come close to the great stuff I have for you. Don't you worry. You don't have to worry about not existing. You're going to exist and it's going to be fantastic. And the resurrection of the dead speaks to that very need that we have as so much part of our makeup, so much of who we are, that we're going to be with him and it's going to be terrific if we're willing to follow the light to the very best of our ability and turn away from self-deception and lies. And for us as a Messianic Jewish synagogue, that whole idea is concretized most profoundly as we look to this unique person who is the resurrection and the life. And so on this Shabbat morning, I leave you with that happy thought that one day everything is going to be all right. Shabbat Shalom, everybody.
Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah. For Messiah.